seated. Before we begin, you will note that the chair to my right, usually occupied by Justice Abrahamson, is empty today. She is participating. She's on the phone. So if you hear a question from above, it's Justice Abrahamson wanting to get in and ask a question. If I think it's kind of quiet, I may stop whatever's going on and let her try again so you all can hear the question. But she is participating and is watching us on Wisconsin Eye and appearing by telephone today. So with those brief announcements, we will begin. Male versus Wisconsin Injured Patients and Compensation Fund. Are you prepared to begin, counsel? Please do.
May it please the court. Wisconsin is among a majority of states that have enacted damages caps in medical negligence actions. But only Wisconsin requires its medical providers to pay assessments to and participate in a fund that guarantees plaintiffs full recovery of all economic damages, whatever the amount. That's every dollar of lost wages, lost earning capacity, incurred medical expenses, future medical expenses. On top of that, Wisconsin's law guarantees plaintiffs up to $750,000 in non-economic damages. That's the statutory limit, and it is among the highest non-economic damages caps in the country. While this system has no peer, plaintiffs insist that it must go further, that the Wisconsin Constitution mandates a right to uncapped, unlimited, guaranteed, full recovery of each and every dollar awarded by a jury in a medical negligence action. No plaintiff in any other tort context in this state or in any other state enjoys that guaranteed right. Now, plaintiff's primary argument at the end of the day boils down to fairness. But it's not fair is not a constitutional argument. Instead, plaintiffs must demonstrate that beyond any reasonable doubt that this cap on the most uncertain and difficult to quantify form of damages bears no rational relationship to any single legitimate government interest. And this they cannot do.
Well, they raise both a facial and as-applied challenge, right?
Yes, Your Honor, they do. And ultimately, for an as-applied challenge, if you were to get to an as-applied equal protection rational basis challenge, I think that the considerations are the same. But I think that the as-applied challenge fails right out of the box. And the reason why is that in Blake, paragraph 46, this court held that in order to establish an as-applied equal protection challenge, a plaintiff must demonstrate that he or she is being treated differently than other members of the legislatively created class. Here, there is no disparate treatment. Each and every plaintiff who is subject to the cap is treated identically. They receive a $750,000 non-economic damage award. And of course, this rule in Blake makes sense. The equal protection clause is about protecting and promoting the equal application of the law. Now, there are other concerns with the as-applied challenge as well that we can discuss. For example, the circuit court made numerous errors. One of the things that it did is it conducted a total isolation analysis. It looked at the application of the cap in this case and in no others. But this court's precedents in cases like Smith, in cases like Quintana, direct the court to look at the application of the law to both the plaintiff and others who are similarly situated to the plaintiff. Now, for example, in Quintana, the court didn't do what the circuit court did in this case. In Quintana, which involved the school penalty zone enhancer case, the court didn't say, okay, now this defendant claims that he committed this crime at night. This defendant claims he committed the crime when children were not present. This defendant claims that this crime was committed in a home. Et cetera, that these were unique facts and circumstances. The court didn't say, does applying the school zone penalty enhancer make this particular school safer in this particular case in this particular district? Instead, what the court did is it asked whether or not there was any rational reason to have individuals who committed crimes at night when children were not present, whether there is any rational purpose of having them included or not excluded from the law's classification. And the court didn't engage in this analysis by looking comprehensively at studies. It used its reason and its logic, and it said, crime begets crime, more crime means unsafe neighborhoods, and we don't want to have schools in unsafe neighborhoods. So a proper as-applied rational basis review test, were we to get there, would also confirm what we know to be true, which is these large damage awards like the present case that pose the most risk of liability to the fund, and that the effects of this law are ultimately furthered the most, or the intent of this law is furthered the most by applying it to awards such as the present. And make no mistake, an as-applied ruling in this case would devastate the governmental interests at issue in this law. Why? Because it would mean that each and every case becomes potentially uncapped. And that would mean that actuaries would have to adjust to an uncapped environment. It means assessments would go up, but we know that one of the legislative purposes here is to have assessments go down. We know that insurance premiums are likely to rise, but we know that one of the legitimate government interests at play here is to control insurance premiums, medical malpractice insurance premiums. And we can expect that doctors will look at Wisconsin as an uncapped environment. And what is undisputed in this record is that doctors testified before the legislature and said the existence of a damages cap, of a non-economic damages cap, was critical to their decision to practice medicine in Wisconsin.
Counsel, in Ferdinand, we said that the fund essentially functioned as an umbrella Med-Mal insurance policy, right?
I think that's correct, yes.
Okay. Well, do you have any quibbles about that characterization?
It is true that the fund provides a secondary level of protection, both coverage to coverage to medical providers. I would agree with that.
Okay. Insurance policies, by their nature, have policy limits. Yes?
That is correct. Generally true.
Why shouldn't we just look at this like an insurance policy? Insurance policies don't cause equal protection problems because they have limits. Why should this be any different?
Well, I agree that the court should look at the fact that insurance policies have limits as one of the reasons why it makes perfect sense for the legislature to impose a limit on a non-economic damages cap in this environment. And I think that that question underscores what is the reliability or predictability goal that is stated within the legislation, and one that was, I think, confused by the circuit court. And that is the fact by having a limit on one type of damages, you allow actuaries, et cetera, to make better predictions about what those liabilities are ultimately going to be. And so the predictability goal of the statute is furthered by having a limitation. Now, there was some discussion this morning in the Porter case about Ferdinand, and I want to emphasize that we do believe that Ferdinand should be properly overruled, but that Ferdinand is not dispositive in this case. And let me explain three primary reasons why. First, the Ferdinand court acknowledged that caps are not per se unconstitutional in this context. It so follows that there must be some cap at some level that would be constitutional. Second, the facts and circumstances ultimately are different in this case. We have learned from the experience of Ferdinand, and there is a different legislative record at play here. For example, as I had mentioned, though the Ferdinand court found that there was no evidence establishing a connection between a doctor's decision as to where to practice and the legitimate state interest of attracting doctors to Wisconsin, there was testimony before the legislature where doctors said that the existence of a cap was necessary to their decision to come and practice medicine. There was testimony by physician recruiters who testified that after Ferdinand came down, physicians withdrew their applications, choosing not to practice in an environment that did not have a cap. Second, we know from Ferdinand that once Ferdinand was issued, that assessment spiked. 25% of the assessments to the fund, they spiked. While the Ferdinand court didn't exactly analyze whether or not controlling assessments was a legitimate government interest, it's certainly an objective of this legislation, And as this court has held in cases like Aker, controlling medical malpractice liability costs is a legitimate government interest. It serves a legitimate public purpose, and that is to promote the affordability and accessibility of health care for all. Third, I think the Ferdinand Court criticized, particularly the concurrence, criticized the legislature for selecting a cap number of $350,000 plucked out of thin air, I think is what Justice Crooks' opinion says. Well, here, the legislature engaged in a detailed review of the experiences of other states, of expert studies. It heard testimony from expert witnesses, from members of the public, from former members of this court. And what that testimony uniformly established is that there is a level where caps begin to have diminishing marginal return on effectiveness. And even the Ferdinand Court itself recognized that caps set above $1 million would have a diminishing marginal return. And that there was a level, they were operating under the reality that there was a level that was so low that this court wasn't going to approve it. In addition to that, the legislature had a desire to provide for adequate compensation.
Mr. St. John, of the states that have caps on the non-economic damages, where does Wisconsin's $750,000 fall in relation to the others?
Wisconsin's is among the very highest in the country, but I want to underscore that no other state requires its providers to pay assessments to a fund that guarantees full recovery of that $750,000, which I think is one of the rational basis ultimately behind the law. By having the cap in place, it helps secure fund integrity. And fund integrity is used to make good on this guaranteed compensation. So unlike a damages cap in another state, a plaintiff here who receives a non-economic damage award will receive actual payment.
In another case that our chambers authored several years ago, ordering then Governor Doyle to return about $250 million to the Patients Compensation Fund, I assume that the fund still has its financial integrity.
Absolutely, Your Honor. The Board of Governors of the fund must manage the fund in a way that is consistent with its fiduciary duties and obligations to both medical providers and to proper claimants. And when one conservatively manages a fund, one of the principal purposes of that fund is to be able to make good on each and every payment in each and every case, no matter the number of claims that there are, no matter the severity of claims there are. The system is designed so that the fund would have considerably more money than any individual award so that it could make good on all awards.
Counsel, in paragraphs 21 through 25, the Court of Appeals goes through the similar things that you're going through now, except you're not really necessarily refuting what they say, and I'd like you to respond to it. Let's start with the financial integrity, which you're on, which is in paragraph 25. The Court of Appeals indicates in discussing the financial integrity, I'm going to wait. Do you want to get that opinion in front of you, or can you do it without?
Yes, Your Honor.
Court of okay. Thank you,
Your Honor.
Court of Appeals opinion. And paragraphs 21 through 25 go through the items that you were just discussing, but you're not hitting the gravamen of some of what they're saying, and I would like you to do that and respond to it. For instance, in paragraph 25, maintaining the financial integrity of the fund as the basis of the cap. The Court of Appeals says in that paragraph, the record demonstrates that as of 2014, the fund has assets of $1.2 billion. It's obvious the fund's financial solvency has not been negatively impacted by claims when, in fact, the fund's assets have grown. Can you respond to what their points are, please?
I'd be happy to respond to that point regarding fund integrity. I think that the Court of Appeals observation here might be that the fund or the cap isn't necessary to have a fund. But necessity is an idea that sounds in strict scrutiny. It doesn't sound in rational basis review. Of course, the legislature could create a...
What I want you to do is, it's, that's not the way that I read paragraph 25. They're saying financial integrity, that was one of the basis in Ferdinand. The record demonstrates... approximately $1.2 billion. It's obvious that it's not been negatively impacted.
Your Honor, if I may continue, In a world which you do not have a cap, what you must do is to raise the funds from other sources, and that is assessments. That just demonstrates the rational connection between having a cap in place and the legislative interest in reducing the cost of overall assessments and reducing the cost of medical liability insurance. And that's exactly what the state did. In the eras where there was no cap in place, assessments were high. In the eras where caps were placed, put in place, assessments were stabilized and then ultimately declined. And this is an important component of the rational basis test or any damages cap, is that the legislature is ultimately trying to advance multiple interests. It's trying to promote affordable health care. It's trying to promote accessible health care. It's trying to make good on a guarantee to all plaintiffs. And it is, this court has held repeatedly that the balancing of those interests, those individual interests, those are quintessentially questions for the legislature and not this court. When they become questions for this court, that ultimately becomes a public policy analysis.
Just one more. I won't go through all of them, but you also mentioned retention, paragraph 21 of the Court of Appeals opinion. And it says, in the years since the Ferdinand decision, the number of physicians participating in the fund has increased every year, indicating that the cap increase has little to no effect on physician retention. And then they go on to say that, indeed, data in the record before us indicates that the existence of or non-existence of a non-economic damage cap has no demonstrable consistent effect on physician retention.
Madam Chief Justice, I see my
yes,
light is on.
Yes, your red light is on, but you can answer her question.
Thank you very much. I think it's a curious read of the evidence to conclude that the fact that physician numbers are increasing in a world where a cap exists somehow proves that a cap is not relevant to physicians increasing. And what the Court of Appeals didn't do is confront the evidence that the legislature heard, which can be incontrovertible. And that evidence was that physicians told the legislature they would not practice in Wisconsin but for the existence of the cap. And physician recruiters told the legislature that the moment burden came down, those applications are withdrawn. I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Yes, of course.
Thank you, Your Honor.
As you will begin, Solicitor, it would help the court if you want us to focus our questions on some particular area of the dispute before us.
Thank you, Your Honor. Misha Zaitlin, Solicitor General on behalf of the state of Wisconsin. Although the state agrees with the fund that the cap here complies with Ferdinand, because the legislature did precisely the careful, painstaking work in selecting the $750,000 figure that the controlling two-justice concurrence contemplated, the state requests that this court go further and overrule Ferdinand. The reason for that, Your Honors, is to bring this court's jurisprudence with regard to economic medical malpractice damage caps in line with the rest of its rational basis jurisprudence, and in line with the rest of its jurisprudence with regard to damages caps in other areas, and indeed in this specific area. Now, under Article 14, Section 13 of the Wisconsin Constitution, the Wisconsin legislature has a specific authority to alter or suspend the common law. The legislature has often exercised this authority to limit common law causes of action, whether it is by enacting statutes of repose, statutes of limitations, or, yes, damages caps.
Counsel, could the legislature have eliminated non-economic damages as an item of recovery?
Yes, it could have, Your Honor. This court in Acre specifically said that the legislature, under that constitutional provision that I referenced, has the authority to, quote, abrogate the common law on policy grounds. In fact, the legislature has deleted some common law causes of action that sound very much in the concerns of non-economic damages. For example, the legislature has specifically eliminated the alienation of affection common law cause of action. The legislature, under that specific constitutional authority, would have the power to do so, but it has not done so here. What it has done here is something far more common, the kind of thing that this court upheld in Marin, Stanhope, Bosco, which is to set a cap on damages, in this case, non-economic damages. Now, what's striking about those other caps is that a lot of them are significantly more stringent, significantly harsher on plaintiffs than what we're dealing with here. And let me give the court one example. And here I'm talking about the cap on damages of suits brought against state officials, which is analogous to the municipal damages cap that this court upheld in cases like Stanhope or Bosco. If this case, the exact same facts that happened in this case, had happened in a UW hospital with a UW physician, the same failure to inform and the same grievous injuries, the cap would have been $250,000 of total damages, not the guaranteed almost $9 million that were obtained here, but only $250,000. And there's no serious question that that cap is constitutional. Now, in Marin, this court upheld a cap of $150,000 for wrongful death non-economic damages. Again, more stringent than what we're dealing with here. Now, in each of those cases, the cap was justified by a legitimate state interest. Here, the cap here is obviously justified by several legitimate state interests, which this legislature specifically enumerated, and I'd like to talk briefly about two of them. First is controlling the cost of health care. And the way the cap achieves this is really economics 101. If you have less high unpredictable awards, that means less payments from the fund and insurance. As a matter of basic economics, that means lesser assessments on physicians and lesser insurance premiums, which, again, under basic economics, leads to less cost on consumers. That itself is sufficient to justify the cap. In fact, as this court specifically said at paragraph 109 of Marin, it is, quote, hard to conceive of a more rational means to assuage fears of damages awards and reigning insurance costs than capping non-economic damages. That passage in Marin, standing by itself, is sufficient to sustain this cap. But there is, of course, more. As the fund's attorney properly articulated, the legislature had before it powerful evidence that physicians told the legislature, after Ferdin, that they would not locate in Wisconsin if it was an uncapped environment. And that is supported not only by the legislative record, but also, again, by common sense. If you have a world where the majority of states have have damages caps, and physicians are highly in demand, they are going to look at a state that has an uncapped environment as a less advantageous place to operate. Now, of course, there are many other decisions that go into where a physician will locate herself or himself and their family. But, of course, this is an important input. The price of the insurance, the price of the assessments, the likelihood that they're going to be subject to an uncapped, unlimited, non-economic damages situation is something that the majority of states have taken into account and the Wisconsin legislature rationally took into account. Now, judicial second-guessing of the cap-specific level, as Ferdin authorizes, places courts in the impossible position of making legislative, not judicial, judgments. Now, here, of course, there is a sufficient record basis for the $750,000 cap because the legislature was properly responding to what this court, especially the controlling justice concurrence, had told it in Ferdin. But the truth is, if the cap's level was set higher, the cap's goals would be achieved less, while patient recovery would be achieved more, and vice versa. As this court explained in Stanhope, whatever cap level the legislature selects will be arbitrary in the sense that it's based upon imponderables. The courts in our separation of powers do not have the authority to decide those imponderables. The court's authority is limited to asking the simple question, does the cap achieve legitimate state interests? If it does, that should be the end of the inquiry. That was the end of the inquiry in Marin. That was the end of the inquiry in Stanhope. And that was the end of the inquiry in Bosco. And there's no reason it should be different in this area, which is why it is so critical that this court not only uphold the cap, but overrule Ferdin and bring this court's case law into consistency.
Counsel, is that also the inquiry where the states that have imposed the caps in economic recovery of economic damages have been challenged?
That's right, Your Honor. There's a variety of caps that some states have imposed. Some states have imposed a global cap. some states have imposed just on non-economic damages. As your colloquy with my friend for the fund properly demonstrated, Wisconsin is on the more generous side of that ledger. There are some states that don't have it, but most states have a cap of some sort.
But the analysis remains as you articulated, whether it's rationally related to a reasonable state, whether it's reasonably related to a rational state interest.
Right, to a legitimate state interest. That's correct, Your Honor. Now, if I may, I'd like to take a minute to talk about the as-applied aspect that Justice Siegler asked about. The state, of course, agrees with the fund that under this court's decision in Blake, an as-applied challenge of the sort that was articulated here is simply outside the bounds of what as-applied rational basis cases look at. But I think there's actually two other reasons why this court should not go down the road of opening up this new novel as-applied challenge. First, opening up an as-applied challenge in this context would completely defeat the cap's purposes. The fact of the matter is, whenever you have high non-economic damages, you're going to have truly, truly tragic cases, which means that one of two things will happen. Either every as-applied claim would win, for the same reasons that the circuit court gave here, or some random number of as-applied claims would lose. But the harm to the interests of the fund would be the same. Actuaries advising the fund would have to advise the fund to increase assessments. Insurance companies would increase rates. Physicians would look at Wisconsin as an uncapped environment.
Listen, but as I understand it, the fund now is at $1.5 billion, is that about right, or is that not in the record?
I believe the record number is little south.
1.2 is the record.
I believe the latest record number is a little north of 1.2. Yeah, I think
okay.
That's correct.
The Goldilocks number, just right. I hearken back to in response to your comments. The Court of Appeals opinion, paragraphs 21 to 25 again. And they reflect on the evidence presented in the years since Fruden was decided regarding the vitality of the fund, that so few claims have been paid since the inception. I think since 1975, 11% of the claims that were made have been paid. Only a handful of claims have been paid in the last 2 years, I think, maybe no more than a handful. So your argument to me that the sky may be falling doesn't resonate. So respond to me. Why am I wrong? Why shouldn't I be up in arms about this?
Even if
the state of the record is set forth in paragraphs 21 to 25.
Madam Chief Justice, may I answer the question?
Yes, you may.
Even if Your Honor is not concerned about the specific interests of the fund integrity, I've articulated several other reasons that are clearly sufficient and clearly stand without regard to the fund integrity interest. But I will note, as Justice Kelly properly expressed during the prior argument, it would be a strange doctrine indeed where the constitutionality of a law would jump in and out of favor based upon contingent events, especially when the contingent event here is the prudential management by the fund of its assets. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. My name is Dan Rotier. I represent Ascaris and Antonio Mayo. To my left is Susan Tyndall, who authored the briefs throughout this case, and James Fergal, who tried the case with me. I want to discuss with you both the as-applied challenge as well as the facial challenge, and in that order. But I think it's worthwhile if I could take a few moments to talk about things that are really not in dispute. In 1975, the legislature enacted the creation of the fund. There was no cap. A cap wasn't integrated into the system, and these dates can be found in the Morgan decision, until 1986. And it was a $1 million cap with a 5-year sunset provision. That then sunset, and it was in 1995 that the $350,000 cap was applied, subject to modification by the Consumer Price Index. Verdon invalidated that, and then in 2006, the current cap of $750 was adopted without adjustment by inflation. And in our brief, we discussed in a footnote, and it can be extended by looking at the CPI, the current relationship between the 350 cap and the 750 is they're about $30,000 apart. The Verdon 350 cap would currently be worth about $580,000. The 750 cap, which was in 1996 or 2006 dollars, is now worth about $610,000. So they're very close. What else do we know about this case? There was no challenge at the trial court level or at the appellate level of the reasonableness of the non-economic award. So we have a legitimate determination of damages here. And as you know, and it's not at all unusual on large damage verdicts, that the trial court is asked to address whether there was perversity or prejudice, or if it was excessive, they might reduce it with an option under the powers rule. They were not challenged in this case on any of those bases at any level. So what we have is a legitimate determination, implicitly acknowledged by the other side, of a reasonable award for non-economic damages.
Mr. Otier, wouldn't a reasonable explanation for that be that they would be, the defendants would be relying on the cap?
No, the cap was an issue at the time motions after verdict were filed. The cap, the as-applied challenge, was in the air. That was going to be ruled upon by the court. And I have no doubt if the defense had any argument that the damages were excessive, they would have been made at that time.
No, I'm not saying, right.
The only point
I agree with you. I agree that no one made an issue of the excessive.
I just want to take out of the argument any notion that this is an excessive
determination. A windfall. No, I don't think anybody is saying that.
All right. So what's the next step we might want to look at? What is the unequal protection of the law? If a person has non-economic damages of $750,000 or less, they get 100% of them. If a person has non-economic damages over $750,000, they will get only a percentage. And the worse the legitimately determined damages are, the less percent they get.
Right, but that's true of every cap, so that means the legislature could never impose any cap.
Now, I disagree with you with all respect. The municipal caps and the state caps, those arose after Holitz versus Milwaukee in 1961. When sovereign immunity was abrogated, and our firm handled the case, and the Supreme Court in that case said the Wisconsin can be forced to limited sovereign immunity. However, it could put notice requirements and caps on it. So for all the municipal caps and the state caps,
you know what I'm talking about. I'm talking about these caps on medical malpractice. You're saying there could never be caps on medical malpractice.
I haven't said that. We haven't said it in our brief. And I'll address it.
You're going to have to explain it to me, because if you're saying that this violates equal protection, I don't see how any cap would not, based on the rationale as you've articulated it.
Let me try to address your question. The governing principle is equal protection. However, the state, in certain circumstances, for a rational basis, or in some cases a more compelling reason, can treat people unequally. As the current system exists, with $1.4 billion in assets and over $1 billion in surplus, unneeded money, the countervailing arguments made by the legislation do not work. They are not rational. Now, what if 20 years from now, 10 years from now. The fund has $100 million. We're losing doctors. It's a whole different story. But in the current state of affairs, there is no rational basis to take away constitutional protection.
So because the statute, the purpose of the statute is working, it is irrational. Its application is irrational.
I think I would view it differently. Because because the insuring structure is working, those objectives are being met. Let me run through them very quickly for you. Acquiring doctors. At the hearings that were mentioned, two or three doctors said, I wouldn't have come here without a cap. Maybe so. Meantime, 18,000 doctors are practicing without a cap. Put yourself in the shoes of a doctor, and you want to come to Wisconsin. There is no personal liability in Wisconsin, with or without a cap. If you're recruiting a doctor to the Gunderson Clinic, and you say to them, there is no personal liability, irrespective of the amount of the economic award or whether or not there's a cap, what better recruitment tool is there? Where are the doctors going in this country? Massachusetts, New York, Florida? No caps. Minnesota, our twin, based on demographics? Where do people want to practice? Mayo Clinic. They have no caps. Their premiums are 48th, 49th in the country with no caps.
Counsel, I'd like to address perhaps a predicate question. Could the legislature have entirely eliminated non-economic damages as a category of recovery?
If they attempted that, I think they would have to demonstrate a rational basis to treat victims of medical negligence differently from victims of other types of negligence, whether it be legal malpractice or automobiles, anything of that sort.
Well, let's look at workers' compensation. Non-economic damages were eliminated there, correct?
Yes, effectively, yes.
Okay. So is there an equal protection issue between a statutory scheme that has essentially a cap of zero and other schemes that have a non-zero cap?
I think the difference in that context was the elimination of the need to show fault. So a completely substitute system was enacted where if you proved you're on the job and you were hurt, that was it. It could even be your own fault.
Okay. So in this case, the legislature has created a compensation scheme in which there is guaranteed recovery for all economic damages, yeah? And then a cap on non-economic. So why is that not just as rational of a legislative schemata as workers' comp?
Because the workers' comp was an entire replacement of the common law, and it occupied that field. In this case, we believe there's no rational basis for the caps. And it does, in fact, play off of the existence of the fund.
All right. So let me just stop you there. I want to take you to a couple of quotes from our prior cases. Well, I'll start with the Constitution, which says the legislature may alter or suspend the common law. You agree with that?
Yes.
Okay. In Acher versus Wisconsin Patients Compensation Fund, we said the legislature may define and limit causes of action and may abrogate common law on policy grounds. You agree?
There is that provision.
I'm sorry?
There is that provision.
Okay, and do you agree with that?
I agree it's one provision of the Constitution.
Well, right, but what we said in Acher that the legislature may define and limit causes of action. You agree with that?
If it satisfies the other obligations and rights in the Constitution.
Such as?
Equal protection.
Okay. So was there an equal protection issue when the legislature eliminated non-economic damages in the workers' compensation field?
No, because it was eliminated for all workers.
Okay. So here, if non-economic damages were eliminated for everyone, then there wouldn't be an equal protection issue, would there?
There wouldn't be a distinct class within the victims of malpractice. The issue would be a larger one. Whether equal protection would be violated relative to non-medical malpractice victims of torts.
Okay, good. So let's follow up on this. So if the legislature kept, set the cap at zero, there would be no equal protection issue if we're just looking at medical malpractice, correct?
I think that's true.
Okay. So how is it that there could be an equal protection issue if you set a non-zero cap?
Because within the category of victims of medical malpractice, there is no rational basis to compensate the more severely injured people at a less and less percentage. So, for example, let me give you an example, if I may.
Mm-hmm.
Let's suppose a verdict came out and it was $800,000 against a $750 cap, and the fund was solvent. Okay, that's a different, the rational basis, at least certainly in an as-applied argument, that's a different question than what we have here, whether Mr. and Mrs. Mayo should receive less than 5% of their legitimate damages by reason of the claimed benefits to the state.
Right. So your argument is that the cap hits the more severely injured harder, correct?
Yes.
Okay. So if we set the cap at zero, that's still true, isn't it?
That is true, but you're not violative of the equal protection within the victims of medical malpractice.
Why?
Because they are being treated the same.
They're all getting zero, right?
Correct.
Okay. But the more severely injured are losing out more than the less severely injured.
Theoretically, yes.
Okay. So why is that not an equal protection issue?
Because the Constitution says you can abrogate certain causes of action as long as it's compliant with other provisions in the Constitution.
All right. So if you can set a I'm sorry, just one last question. If you can set a zero cap with no equal protection issue, and the legislature decides we're going to be more generous than zero, then all of a sudden they have to have no cap?
They have to treat everyone within that category equally. And under the current circumstances, and I can go through the data with you if you wish, none of the stated objectives in the legislation are rational. Let me just run through them quickly. Financial solvency. In 2013, the Audit Bureau told the fund, you should get rid of your surplus down to $380 million. In 2013, they said you should set a maximum surplus. In 2015, the fund agreed that it should be $376 million. This is October of 2015. At that time, the surplus was $783 million. They've cut the premiums again and again. In the last premium round, they remitted equity to pay for part of the cost. And yet now, in the December report, we have $1,044 million in surplus. And why does it happen? It's not just investment returns. It happens because each and every year, the underwriters look at the reserves they've created for claims not even yet reported, and they reduce them. They reduce them because they've exaggerated the potential concerns. And I'd ask that you not think the growth of this fund is caused by a rising stock market. The fund's rules limit its investment to 20% in equities, 80% in fixed investments. So this continual growth is not a result of lucky investment in equities. Now, briefly, I want to mention Morgan. Morgan said...
Before you get there, I have a question that I've been trying to get in, and it was addressed by the other side, and I don't want you to leave without your having an opportunity to comment on it. We've been asked to overrule Ferdinand to the extent that we no longer use the, quote, rational basis with teeth, but go back to a standard rational basis test to review the caps that are at issue here. What is your strongest argument that you should still prevail even if we were to do that and simply employ rational basis?
I think you should employ rational basis, and I think this many decades long attempt to find just the right adjective and modifier has caused more trouble than it's worth. It was the United States Supreme Court which said this is a rational basis examination is not a toothless one. So with the not being a toothless one, it became one with teeth. And then when it got teeth, there's always the concern about bites. But I heard in the Porter case the argument that the Milwaukee Brewer statement regarding rational basis was acceptable to the Attorney General. I highly recommend the Milwaukee Brewer language. And what it talks about is the legislature will always have a rationale for everything it does. That does not mean it's rational. And those reasons have to be examined in a meaningful way. Now I risk throwing another adjective with meaningful way, but it has to be a rational basis review. It cannot be solely deferential in the sense that if they passed it, it must be okay. Because that would be an abdication of this court's responsibility. After all, what you're engaged in is scrutiny. There's strict scrutiny, intermediate, and this level of scrutiny. You cannot scrutinize something without looking at the stated reasons and determining whether they're rational. Yes, the challenging party has to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. And yes, if a rational basis is established to some extent, if it's less than what the court would want, it doesn't matter as long as it's rational to some extent. And then deference steps in. So that's the best I would say in terms of phrasing this. I don't think the bite thing, I mean, you have all read these cases. You can go back the last 30 years. And whichever side felt the statute was unconstitutional, they did their examination with more vigor. How about that? We'll forget bite. More vigor. And then the other side would dissent, and then a few years later, when things were different, you'd see the opposite arguments. But what is consistent, I think, in the jurisprudence, and it does go back to Jelke as well, the rational basis test has to be meaningful, and it's more than just a review of something being stated. It has to be rational.
But, Mr. Rotier, as you know, the traditional rational basis test includes the court, for lack of a better word, conjuring or imagining its own understanding of what could be a basis, a rational basis for it, a legitimate basis.
You know, that doesn't really bother me that much because I don't think the legislature should have to state in each and every case its rationale. You know, if they want to set a speed limit at 35, I don't know that you need a preamble that lays everything out. On the other hand, if they do lay out some factors, as they did in this case, when they enacted this statute, that doesn't mean they're absolute. Let me give you another example. Defensive medicine. This is the one that I find totally illogical. So you're a doctor, and you're deciding whether to run an unnecessary test, and you're saying to yourself, well, I've got unlimited liability. I might get sued for $10 million in economic damages, and I might get sued for $750 in non-economic damages, but I sure don't want to get sued beyond that. And then they order another test. It's illogical. It could be said that the absence of personal liability might reduce defensive medicine if it exists. Another rhetorical question. Do you think the University of Wisconsin's physicians with the CAF do less tests and fewer tests than Aurora or Gunderson or Marshfield? There is no rational explanation tying defensive medicine to the existence of a cap. Again, you can look at Minnesota with no cap. Is there evidence there's defensive medicine in Minnesota? If there is, it's not driven by the absence of, there's no proof it's driven by the absence of a cap. So the main arguments the legislature looked at was defensive medicine, numbers of doctors, and personal liability is the most important protection a doctor could get, and stability and solvency of the fund, and stability of, and the ability to predict large damage awards. I'd suggest to you, if you've got $1.4 billion invested, The daily swing in those investments is probably less than the $15.75 million that wasn't paid in this case.
So why does that go to the constitutionality of the statute rather than to the efficacy of the actuary's decisions?
I'm sorry, Justice, I missed.
Yeah, so I'm wondering why the fact that you just, or the statement that you just made, goes to the constitutionality of the statute rather than the wisdom of the actuary who's governing the fund.
I think here's the interplay. If it was demonstrable that the stated points made by the legislature did in fact hold down claims and provide stability and bring doctors and limit defensive medicine, if that could be established, you would still have to look, I believe, at the size of the fund to determine the strength of those arguments. Well, one of the arguments was this cap is necessary to provide stability to the fund. This fund has been stable since day one. It started with $0 in 1976.
Right. Now, why doesn't that just create a grievance on the part of the doctors being assessed for the fees that go into creating the fund and saying, you're assessing me too much?
Well, I've certainly thought about that over the years and whether we could determine a cause of action for the doctors. There are two problems with it, though.
Now, I said grievance, not cause of action.
By the way, in the Morgan case, the trial lawyers filed an amicus to support the medical society on taking the $200 million. But let me be more serious. Morgan said the fund creates a constitutionally protected property right, not just for the health care providers, but for proper claimants, and we are proper claimants.
Yes. According to its terms.
The statute defines proper claimants.
And the proper claimants are those who seek proper recoveries.
I would disagree with that. To me, it means a claimant who has established liability and damages have been determined. I think that's a different definitional issue than the cap issue. But let me finish the answer. Who has paid these premiums into the fund? It's the public through health care, and the biggest contributor? The federal government. Because these payments by doctors and hospitals are tax deductible. So 30% of this, probably more than 30% of this, has come from the government. So it's not a situation where the money can just be given back to the doctors or the previous generation of doctors. I do think there's been an actuarial problem going on forever within the fund, but that to me is a non-constitutional issue. Let me talk about as-applied first, and my time is short. At the trial court level, the trial judge addressed the facial constitutional challenge before trial. We suggested it be done after trial because statistically the defense wins 8 or 9 out of 10 cases, and we thought it was an unnecessary exercise, but he did. He had the right to do it. But he reserved on the facial challenge. On the facial challenge, and we followed the guidelines of society insurance to the letter, because it was one of the most recent cases on as-applied. And the analysis in an as-applied is specifically on the facts of that case and the effect of the law. It does not allow questions about, well, what if it's a million less or a million more? That's a facial issue. As-applied, the question is, as this cap is applied to the males, does it violate equal protection or due process? And we argue in a case where someone gets less than 5% at a time when the fund has a surplus of $1 billion does violate concepts of equal protection. If you compare them to somebody who got an $800,000 award and had to forfeit $50,000, they are being treated drastically different. If you look at the verdict, if you apply this cap and you calculate the attorney's fees provided by statute, and you looked at the record on subrogation, these people didn't get enough money to cover their future medical bills. They didn't get enough money to cover the future medical bills determined by the jury.
Why did they not? I thought
because
that they...
traditionally... I'm sorry.
No, you go ahead. You think you know where I'm going. I thought that was part of what they did recover.
If you look at the past medical went back to the insurance companies that paid it. The future medical is going to the healthcare field. There was an award for impairment of earning capacity, although the fund had an expert say there was no impairment of earning capacity for a 50-year-old African-American woman in Milwaukee with no hands and no feet. They presented that proof. Everything in that verdict was going to others other than the impairment of earning capacity and the $750, if that's limited. And yet, from the gross, attorney's fees by statute are a third in the first million and 20% thereafter. And it's not in the record, but you can estimate what you think about the cost of prosecution of a case where there were 20 experts. And on the record, one of them, I do recall, for the defense, billed $55,000 before arriving in the courtroom. So there was a lot of money spent by both sides. And when it all shakes out, in many cases, whether it's medical malpractice or not, the non-economic recovery helps to spread the cost of prosecution and the fees and ending up netting people enough to pay their bills. It's an unknown consequence, and I can understand why people don't, it doesn't come to them immediately. It's not a constitutional argument as such, but it's a practical argument why doing such a drastic 95% reduction can cause so much harm in a case like this.
But you're not saying that her future medical bills are not going to be paid. You're just saying they're not going to be put in her pocket before they're paid.
No, I'm saying if all the operating assumptions proven at trial and her life expectancy remains as testified to, she will not be able to pay all her future medicals.
With the award that she got from the jury?
Yes. It was
because of
medicals are $7.1 million.
Right, because of attorney's fees and costs.
Primarily, and subrogation going back to the health insurance people. It's just a practical consequence of what happens here. And when you scrutinize for a reasonable basis, and as the question, can we look to other reasons, there's another reason, a practical reason. Why isn't the cap a floor? Why don't we say we don't give anybody the first $750? Or we don't give anybody the first $500,000. And then the argument coming back, well, it's for predictability. Do you think American family can predict hurricanes? And I understand a little town mutual worried about a big claim where they might buy reinsurance to protect themselves. But we have a fund with $1.4 billion. In the last 5 years, they average 4 claims a year paid. And all of them under the $750. In the last 12 years, this passed in 2006, I'm the first person to be before this court with a verdict in excess of the cap. So how frequently do you think this is going to occur? Plaintiffs going to have to win the case, which is a 10 to 20% likelihood in this state. They're going to have to get non-economic damages beyond $750, and they're going to have the wherewithal to continue the challenge beyond the trial court level, if as applied is utilized. As applied has these unique provisions, and it's an option. You've got really three options as I see it. You could affirm the as applied as determined by Judge Cohen, and I encouraged a reading of the concurrence by Judge Brash. That was well thought out, and although he disagreed with the facial, he said the as applied arguments were sustainable. And if you granted affirmance on the as-applied determination, one option you have is to vacate that portion of the Court of Appeals decision that addressed the facial challenge. I'm here representing only Mr. and Mrs. Mayo. And if affirmance of the as-applied and vacation of the facial is the route you take, they will recover. It may not end the story, because there will be other cases where a facial challenge will be made, or an as-applied, or both. But that is an option you have. You also, of course, have the option of total affirmance or total reversal. But I think it's important, and you might recall, when the questions were certified from the Court of Appeals, we laid out that potential for this court, saying you shouldn't answer the certified questions because the Court of Appeals could have just affirmed Judge Cohen and then not taken up the facial challenge. So that avenue is available to you. And if you read society closely, we have met all of the criteria of society, and there is a balancing test, and Judge Barash engaged in it very well in his concurrence and said, given the legitimacy of these damages, as determined by the jury and not appealed from, in comparison to the one at that time, $1.2 billion of assets, it is irrational to think that payment of this amount is somehow going to alter these stated objectives in the legislation. It's not going to bring one more doctor here, and it's not going to eliminate one unnecessary test. It just isn't going to happen. This state has many good things going for it in the healthcare field. The elimination of personal liability is the best thing you've got going for it. If you go to Chicago and you look at how things are run there, it's a different game. It's all leveraging the personal liability of the physicians. And if the doc doesn't have enough money, you sue the doctor as an agent of the hospital. We don't do that in Wisconsin. Wisconsin, we've benefited by the unlimited liability and the availability of the fund. We don't have to sue five doctors if there's one primary doctor involved.
Thank you, counsel.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you very much.
Mr. Rotier ended with society insurance, so there's where I'm going to begin. He says that his as-applied claim is based on society insurance. Society insurance is a case involving the retroactive application of a law. The rational basis test in cases involving the retroactive application of the law is different than the rational basis test when you're dealing with prospective legislation. In those retroactivity cases, although there's some disagreement about this court as to what should be done, this court has acknowledged that there is a private versus public balancing test that takes place. But in the rational basis context applicable here, as Justice Ziegler wrote in the Land's End case, the rational basis test is not whether, on balance, a private interest outweighs the public interest. The rational basis test is not simply picking and choosing whether the interests of one group are more important than the other. Those are legislative determinations, and they are not subject to this court's balancing. We go to the next step. Mr. Rotier said that if the fund is no longer needed anymore, then there has to be more government interest that somehow is supported through attracting doctors to Wisconsin or by reducing medical insurance premiums or all the other things that the legislation promotes that has nothing to do with the fund. There again, the rational basis test is not one where we evaluate the degree in which the law furthers a government interest. It simply asks whether there is a rational connection between the legislative interest and a legitimate state ends. And here there is. Mr. Rotier went and spoke at length about the size of the fund, and I think it bears addressing. The purpose of the cap is to support fiscal security of the fund. The fund's current fiscal health is in part because the fund works. But as importantly for this court's analysis, the size of the fund has nothing to do with a number of the legitimate state interests which are being advanced by having a cap in place.
But I understood his argument in that regard to be made as part of the as-applied challenge. And the as-applied challenge to the facts of this particular case where, the counsel have shown restraint in not going over the particulars of it, but the injuries are horrific and obviously, the jury found that way. You have a 95% reduction worked by the cap, and you have a fund that's running, from what I gathered, about $1.5 billion to the good. So that's how I took his argument. Not that. So please, I'd be interested in hearing your response to that.
Thank you, Your Honor. We don't dispute that the injuries to Ms. Mayo were severe in this case. Involves severe injuries, and this cap is applied in cases where plaintiffs suffer severe injuries. And as this court has recognized in the past, for example, in Neiman, that we do not and cannot dispute the suffering that families experience or the gravities of their loss. However, the role of the judicial branch is to apply the established rules of law to the constitutional issues presented. This is the rule whether it's a facial challenge. This is the rule as to whether it's an as-applied challenge.
Counselor, to me it seems like it depends on how you describe the issue. You set it up differently. He sets up the equal basis challenge based on those who are most severely injured are denied guaranteed recovery. But that's not the basis that you set up. How can you defend your position using the basis for the equal protection challenge that Attorney Rotier set up?
Well, ultimately, the question is whether or not the classification furthers any legitimate government interest to be sustained. Here, it is true the legislature could raise assessments, just like the municipalities could raise taxes in Bosco, or the municipalities could raise taxes in Stanhope. But here the legislature has chosen a system that promotes fund integrity, that imposes burdens throughout the system. On medical providers, yes, and admittedly there are some burdens placed on plaintiffs. But the decision to place balance or to place burdens upon different persons within a system does not render it unconstitutional.
Can it render it unconstitutional as applied?
It cannot render it unconstitutional as applied.
Why?
Because the question about whether the legislature has appropriately chosen how to balance interests is beyond this court's rational basis purview. But more fundamental point than that, there is no as-applied equal protection challenge in a world in which there is not disparate treatment among members of the class.
But that depends on how you set up the class, which was the way I began speaking to you. I think the way you set it up is quite different than the way Attorney Rotier sets it up.
Every single, if I may answer with my right
hand, yes.
Every single medical malpractice case is going to present a circumstance where you have a severely injured Every single malpractice case is going to set, establish circumstances where there is a fund that, if it's well managed, is going to have assets that are beyond the size of any individual award. There are no unique facts and circumstances here that impair on any unique constitutional right. The plaintiff in this case, the plaintiff in every case, merely has a right to be free of patently arbitrary government classifications. If a law like a cap is to succeed in any circumstance, it must be applied uniformly. And if it's not applied uniformly and there are as-applied challenges that are entertained, there is an invitation to just judicial subjectivity, and the constitutionality of the law at any given time will be in constant flux depending on the size of the fund, which Mr. Rotier admitted. He said that if the size of the fund gets to a certain level at some point, then it will be constitutional. But then if it's managed well, then it will be unconstitutional. And I don't believe that this court's precedents support the idea, either facially or as applied, that the success of a law at advancing a government interest renders it unconstitutional.
Thank you. We are going to take a break before we hear our third case at 1:30. Adjourned.